From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point this year. Edward Snowden and the NSA, Obamacare's rough launch, a government shutdown, a new pope, and a bombing in Boston. The world was introduced to one young man, Edward Snowden, and an awful lot of leaked insight on government surveillance and the NSA. Here he is, going public in June.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I worked for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA.
On the road to government shutdown, Tea Party icon and Republican Texas Senator Ted Cruz took the floor for 21 hours using Dr. Seuss to go after President Obama's big health care reform.
Do you like green eggs and ham? I do not like them, Sam I am. I do not like green eggs and ham.
And at a November press conference near the end of a difficult year, President Obama said he deserved the American people's frustration over the rocky rollout of the Affordable Care Act.
And, you know, that's on me. I mean, we fumbled the rollout on this health care law.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable takes on a year, 2013, with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post and David Sanger of The New York Times. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your nomination for top story, top trend, top newsmaker, 2013? Where's this year taken you, your thinking, taken us all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back to On Point. You are good and brave to wrap another year with us.
Oh, and I must say this is one I think that we're all feeling a little relieved to see the end.
Let it go, let it go. And from Weston, Vermont, David Sanger joins us, national security correspondent for The New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point. This Vermont year-ender with you is getting to be a tradition. How's the weather up there, sir?
It is, and, you know, I'm looking out over a beautiful field of snow and, you know, snow across the pond. And Karen, I really miss being back in D.C.
It really sounds like it, David.
We feel that. Let's frame this year just a little bit. All the way back to January, there was that day, yes, in Washington, President Obama ending his inaugural speech there, second term, reelected, with a call to action to all citizens of the United States.
You and I, as citizens, have the power to set this country's course. You and I, as citizens, have the obligation to shape the debates of our time, not only with the votes we cast, but with the voices we lift in defense of our most ancient values and enduring ideals.
Reelected and there at the grand inauguration again. And then just last week, maybe the framing on the other end of this year, former NSA contractor Edward Snowden gave a short Christmas address. It was broadcast on the United Kingdom's Channel 4 from his temporary asylum in Russia. Here's Snowden.
We learned that our governments, working in concert, have created a system of worldwide mass surveillance, watching everything we do. A child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. They'll never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves.
Edward Snowden, and boy, did he make news this week, this year, with a leak after leak after leak, a whole big picture painted. Karen Tumulty, you say you're ready to let this one go, this year go. Why? You're there in Washington. There's been good. There's been bad. You're ready to wave it off. Why?
Well, I think starting with the president's inaugural address is a good place to start this year because, you know, it was much more assertive, I think, than a lot of people expected. I mean, this was a guy who had just been reelected, had just narrowly avoided this fiscal disaster at the end of last year. Mm-hmm. And he really asserted an aggressive agenda. And you look at the end of the year and, you know, none of these things happened. There was no major immigration bill, which a lot of people thought was inevitable, even at the beginning of the year. There was no progress toward any long-term solution, no grand bargain of, you know, the entitlement problems and things that are really threatening our economic stability in the future. And, you know, we'd gotten past a fiscal cliff only to stumble into a government shutdown. And then the end of the year, the best you can say about his best achievement, biggest achievement of his first term, health care law, is that it's intact. But it's his credibility has really been damaged on this. And we are into potentially a more treacherous phase of this starting January 1st.
Here's the president at his year-end press conference. This was last Friday, responding to a question from your colleague, David Sanger, the Times reporter Jackie Combs, talking about PolitiFact's choice for the biggest lie of the year, that President Obama had said, if you like your health care plan, you can keep it. Here's the president.
As I said in previous press conferences, we're going to make mistakes, and we're going to have problems, but my intentions have been clear throughout, which is I just want to help as many people as possible feel secure and make sure that they don't go broke when they get sick. And we're going to just keep on doing that.
It's a long way from that inaugural tone to the end of the year press conference. Maybe that's inevitable. But what's going on here, David? Why such headwinds or failure to perform by the president this year?
You know, I think there are two factors. They're the ones that Karen laid out. And you have a president who gives wonderful set speeches, is most comfortable in that, and is great at enunciating a grand vision. And an administration that has shown itself, with a few notable exceptions, say the Bin Laden raid and a few other things we could name, to be extraordinarily poor on execution. Execution really has been their weakness throughout. And whether that is because they control so much centrally through the White House and they simply don't have the capability to run everything with that kind of staff without delegating out, whether it's that they are insufficiently supervising the initiatives they get going. But we've seen this happen time and again. And you've run through a good litany from health care and immigration on the domestic agenda. Let me run you through a couple on the foreign agenda. Syria has been a gaping sore with more than 100,000 dead, and yet the president has failed to really explain America's decisions to stay on the sidelines. I think there's a very good argument for staying on the sidelines, but you don't hear very much about the great humanitarian tragedy that is playing out there, and we have now, of course, seen another one in South Sudan. You heard a wonderful vision during the State of the Union about how America's role in the world can be reconfigured, the pivot to Asia, so forth. And yet again, execution has been poor. And we're in the odd position that if you travel around the Middle East, people say, well, we don't see America quite as much as we used to as a major force. We see you trying to get out, but we don't see you here in present in large numbers since the decision to get out of Iraq and the wind down in Afghanistan. When you go to Europe, you say they say we do see you Americans in large numbers, but they're mostly NSA stations around the place picking up Angela Merkel's cell phone calls. And then you get to Asia, and they say, where are you as the Chinese are being increasingly assertive? So I think one of the big challenges for the president in his remaining 3 years is to go explain how his vision of a different kind of superpower that the U.S. is going to be matches up with how he's performed around the world.
Let's bring that home for starters, Karen. Do you see, David Sanger says, failure to execute at home. There's also famously fierce resistance. Some even say hatred in his opposition. What's the ratio of origin for this failure to move anyway?
Well, I would say that on top of all of that, the president began the year with a faulty premise. And that premise, which we heard him repeat so many times during the 2012 election that it became a cliche, was that the election would, quote unquote, break the fever. And in fact, all of the Washington dysfunction remained. He began the year, the first thing that happens is the Republicans double down on things like Benghazi. We, again, go straight into another government shutdown, something that a lot of us thought was going to be unthinkable after 1995 and that, political disaster. So, yes, he has a very intransigent opposition, one whose, determination was not shaken by the reelection. And there's also increasing criticism from his own party, from people like Leon Panetta, that the president himself has not engaged in the sort of deal making and the kind of reaching out that it takes in Washington. I mean, I don't know that any of this can be solved unless somebody comes up with a way to solve Washington first.
That sounds like a big agenda. David Sanger, do you see some idea percolating in the White House now as we sit here at the end of 2013, how to thread this needle, get out of this? I mean, he's only 1 year in, not even, to his first year of his second term.
That's right. And, you know, the remarkable thing about second terms is they're supposed to be incredibly liberating, right?
I mean, go for it.
The president said again during his news conference he'll never again face the voters. So if you were thinking about the big items on his agenda, from health care to immigration to bringing the world down, moving towards zero nuclear weapons, to, you know, the other major cases that he has made for big change, this is the moment to do it. And within a second term, you really only have the first two and a half years before there's so much focus on the next presidential election.
One of those almost down right now. David Sanger, please stand by. Karen Tumblety, great to have both of you with us. We're looking at the news and footprint of 2013. Listeners, you can join us. What's your nomination for Top Story 2013? What moved you and the world? What will we remember from this year? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We'll remember Lou Reed, Walk on the Wild Side, 1972. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that patch. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doot, 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 doot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the news and footprint of the year 2013, from Obamacare to Snowden to twerking to the tone of a new pope. David Sanger is with us, national security correspondent for the New York Times. Joins us from Vermont. Karen Tumblety is in Washington, national political correspondent for the Washington Post. A lot of those passed this year. Hugo Chavez gone. Helen Thomas from your White House zone there. Lou Reed, Doris Lessing, Nelson Mandela, of course, famously Margaret Thatcher, Cory Monteith, and the great poet Seamus Heaney. Here he is. He died this year in August. Here he is reading a section of one of his most famous poems, The Cure at Troy, on the BBC with the rhyme, the famous rhyme of hopes and history.
Someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its term. It means once in a lifetime that justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme.
Looking, waiting, always looking for that time. April 15th, two bombs exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, killed three, injured more than 200. WBZ TV anchor John Elias was there, just 30 feet away from where the first bomb went off.
All of a sudden, this explosion happened across the street. This huge white cloud came up off the sidewalk. And initially, everybody froze, everybody, including those in the grandstand, not knowing what it was. And then the second explosion went off two blocks away, not more than 15 seconds or less. And that's when panic sort of struck in. Everybody started to run out. They were jumping on Boylston Street, running toward the runners that were coming down Boylston and running the other way, trying to get away from that area.
It was a bad day, a day of terrorism in the United States. It was not the worst place to be in the world. Just last week, Tuesday, December 17th, ABC News' Terry Moran reported on the continuing civil war in Syria after the government there dropped barrel bombs on civilians and more in the city of Aleppo.
They are scenes out of hell, the hell that Aleppo has become. In one of the worst attacks in this horrific war, government helicopters dropped barrel bombs, large containers filled with explosives, shrapnel, and incendiary materials on several civilian neighborhoods throughout the city over the last 3 days.
There, the scene out of Syria, a hellish scene out of Syria. Kevin Tumblety, how do you read this global picture? David Sanger goes right around the world and talks about a kind of receding profile for the U.S., or at least American power. Is that part and parcel of what President Obama, in a way, aspired to when he came in with a sense of a more modest American presence in the world?
But what has happened is over the last few years, a lot of forces have been unleashed in the Middle East. My colleague Liz Sly has a wonderful story leading the Washington Post about how these are, you know, the seeds for this were actually planted in some ways after World War One, but a lot of these when the, you know, artificial lines were drawn by European map makers in the region. So I don't know. It's such a contrast to just what, you know, it was. How recent was it that we were talking about an Arab Spring? I mean, it just seemed like the whole region was just like bursting in hope. And now, you know, there's so much riding on these upcoming talks to you know, it, with Syria, that it just seems like despair. And every day's headlines get worse. I mean, Iraq remains a violent place.
David Singer, what's your implication here with your tour of the world and the sense of an American profile reduced? You know, President Obama maybe didn't want to see the U.S. as the capital T indispensable nation. Maybe thought it was time for a little time out in our heavy presence all over the place.
Well, he absolutely did, and he said as much. And he said as much during the 2008 campaign. And then, you know, he called Iraq a dumb war and said we would get out of it and executed what was the leftover plan from the Bush era to get us out, and did so. And as Karen has pointed out accurately, the predictable is now happening, that, you know, over time, Iraq is reverting to the mean. And by the end of 2014, the United States should either be completely out of Afghanistan or we'll have a token force of 5,000 or 6,000. But many believe that Afghanistan will return to the mean, which raises two questions. The first is, were we living in some dozen-year-old fantasy that the American intervention in these countries would have some lasting permanent effect? If you went back to Iraq 25 years from now, or back to Afghanistan 25 years from now, what will you find remaining from the great American experiments there? And I think we all believe precious little. Then the second question comes out of that, which is, okay, if you're the world's one remaining superpower, but you can't be everywhere and you can't police every place and you can't solve every Syria and South Sudan that comes along, what is your proper role? And that's where I think the president's light footprint strategy has a bit run aground in his last year. In the first 4 years, he was able to use a combination of drone strikes in Pakistan and elsewhere, cyber strikes in Iran, and the use of special forces, think the bin Laden raid, to be able to hold off a number of big problems, slow the Iranian nuclear program, stop potential acts of terror with the drones. But what you're discovering now is that drones and cyber and special forces don't build up societies very much, and that's why people are wandering around saying, where are the bigger programs from America to change the nature of the world? And that's what the American public clearly does not have an appetite for right now. Every poll shows it.
Of course, there were much bigger programs in Iraq and for a long time in Afghanistan, and here we still are. Let's go to our listeners on this year, 2013. Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think the president has had a strong minus and a strong plus.
Okay.
For the first time, we're actually getting health care for our people, which the rest of the world has had for more than 100 years. Even Iraq had health care under Saddam Hussein. So that's been a shame that he's trying to correct, even though it's being very difficult.
Yep.
On the negative side, though, since he'd been a senator against the Iraq war, when at that time he was so much against war, we thought he'd be a more peaceable president. And the Afghanistan war has continued into its 13th year, our longest war ever. And it's a war that never was even requested or approved by Congress. And every day our soldiers are committing suicide over there, and they're still left there. And also the drones that he's putting around the world. And I think throwing those drones is going to cause such anger toward us. There's going to be desire to get even with us. As we never think about that. We can't go around killing people with drones, even some innocent people, mothers and fathers and elderly and children.
Jackie, we've got it right out of the sky in a wedding party just recently in Yemen. On the other hand, the president, when he comes forward, he says there are real threats in the world. We've got to face them. But that's a dilemma right there. One more, if I may. Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, thank you. Your commentator mentioned that this is an administration that seems to be poor in terms of delegating authority, and that's its weakness. I would suggest that the major problem this administration has had is that it's faced a very, very hateful opposition, an opposition that didn't care one single damn as to what happened to the country just so long as it brought down this opposition. And I would also suggest to you that I can't remember one single time with perhaps the Clinton administration where they had faced an opposition that didn't care what happened to the country and didn't care what happened to its citizens. I'm not being extreme, by the way, in that particular comment.
Hateful opposition. There has certainly been strident opposition, no question about it. Bill, let us hold that thought and get one more. I'll take it to David and Karen. Kathleen in Lincoln, Illinois. Kathleen, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling to complain about Obama's fraudulent second term. From all reports, the Republicans lost mostly because they didn't get the vote out the way the Democrats did. And then months later, we find out the groups that would have gotten the Republican vote out were not allowed to form the way the Democrat groups were because of the IRS scandal.
You're talking about the IRS scandal that came out back in May, that they were looking at nonprofits that had words like Tea Party and such in their applications.
Exactly. All those groups that would have stirred up the Republicans to get out and vote were not allowed to do what they were planning to do.
Kathleen, what about the argument going on within the Republican Party right now, where you've got some mainstream people saying, look, we're shooting ourselves in the foot, fellow Republicans?
Well, I kind of agree with that, too, but if we had some real leadership in the White House, that probably wouldn't be happening quite so much.
Kathleen, I appreciate your call. Karen, you're a national political correspondent. Take on the degree of, first of all, Bill's complaint. He says it's a hateful opposition, not just a principled opposition. And then Kathleen says, well, look, but here, look at the IRS scandal and how the administration's used its tools to maybe undercut the GOP.
Well, certainly by every measure you look at, the Congress is more deeply divided, more deeply polarized than it has been since at least the waning years of the 1800s. That's how far you have to go back looking at the data. But I think that one of the big political stories going on right now, and in many ways I think the most fascinating, is within the Republican Party, where they are trying to sort out who they are, whether the things that they are doing to thwart Obama in the short run are going to hurt them in the long run. And again, you can point to immigration. They have a gigantic demographic problem building against them. And, finally, just to the IRS thing, I don't think there's much evidence that that was determinative in the election, because the Republican outside groups certainly had plenty of money to spend, and they did spend it. In fact, their ground operation was just flat out incompetent, as we saw with the gigantic Mitt Romney campaign operation that was nicknamed Orca, that just essentially failed on election day. So I don't think that that was one of the reasons, but I do think that one of the reasons that the Republican Party is so stridently, in opposition to things, is that a no vote is just about the only thing that is safe to cast these days for a Republican.
David Sanger, what about this global situation where Karen describes at home the most divided Congress in more than a century? Meanwhile, the world is obviously in a time of big transition, China rising, all kinds of shifts in power. What about the implications? In 2013, it seems, the example, Exhibit A of the United States, not really in an ambitious, creative, in-motion state while the world is changing.
It is changing and changing rapidly and in need of leadership, at home and abroad. And so then the question is, what kind of leadership? And clearly, as your first caller indicated, the kind of leadership that we thought we might be executing in Afghanistan and Iraq is not what the way the world was looking for us, or Americans were looking for us to act around the world. And while I disagree with her that on Congress and the authorization for Afghanistan, I think after 9/11, any president would have been required to go into Afghanistan. Iraq is shaping up 10 years later, and it was 10 years ago, 2003, that the U.S. did the invasion, as one of the colossal mistakes of American foreign policy. And I think history will probably record that, one that gained us very little strategic advantage and didn't make much of a change on the ground and, of course, had a horrific human cost for Americans and for Iraqis. But I think, Tom, when you raise the question of China, you raise the issue that, in the end, when we look back at the Obama years, may be the one that historians focus on the most. Because if it turns out that the combination of dysfunction at home, inability to go sort out our issues of budget, our political differences, and an American attitude that this is post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan, a time to stay at home, we may look back at this as a period of time where the Chinese basically had a free period to go exercise influence around the world of the kind that we used to. You know, you go to Indonesia and you visit new libraries that are being built and you discover they are Chinese libraries. You go through Africa and you discover villages that are being rebuilt and they're being rebuilt because the Chinese are trying to obtain oil rights. Even in the Middle East, you're beginning to see a larger Chinese footprint for the best of reasons, because the United States is, and this is something to celebrate from 2013, now producing more energy than we are importing.
Yep.
And that's a big switch, but the result is that we're seeing it as an opportunity, another reason that we can begin to focus more at home and ignore a lot of problems that are abroad.
A time to be bold, maybe to be recreating things for fresh thinking, but are we doing it? Karen, let me get one call. I'll come to you. Steve in Windham, Connecticut. Steve, you're on.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom. Mm-hmm. My political, it's kind of a tragedy, but popcorn moment was watching Ted Cruz take the Tea Party in a la Pickett's charge in the budget shutdown debate. I that was almost surreal. That's my pick for this year.
Let's pick it up, Karen. Tea Party peaked this year, and on the downside or not?
You know, we have a midterm election coming up that's going to give us an answer to that. It will be fascinating to see, in particular, how some of these Republican primaries play out. But I went to Texas a few weeks after the government shutdown and followed Ted Cruz around a bit. And even though the shutdown was largely deemed a colossal, just a political disaster here in Washington, it's interesting to see that in Texas, he really was greeted like a conquering hero coming home. And not only that, but every single Republican who seems to be having any hopes of winning any election statewide seems to be restyling himself as, Ted Cruz, only more so. I even ran into city council candidates who would boast, "I am the Ted Cruz of the Houston City Council." So he is, with a certain element of the party and a large element, he has been enormously influential, and they don't see this as a failure.
Does that mean at the end of 2013 we are not working our way out of this gridlock, that we're still in it, Karen?
You know, the fact that a relatively modest budget deal could be hailed as the kind of breakthrough that it was. You know, we start the year talking about grand bargains. Mm-hmm. And, by the end of the year, averting catastrophe is a victory.
There's a victory of sorts, modest sorts, in 2013. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent with the Washington Post. Please stand by there in Washington. And David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal. Please stand by in that holiday home in Vermont. Just lovely to think of you with your view. I don't know about the bigger view. Listeners, you can join us. What events, trends made you feel hopeful this year? What did not? What was the big news that will matter from 2013? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We'll go out with little Patti Page. She died in January at the age of 85. Here's her hit, Tennessee Waltz, 1950. This is On Point.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee Waltz when an old friend I happened to see. I introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the year 2013. There was a lot of new life in this year. Little Prince George in Britain's royal family. And there were those passing on. Nelson Mandela, the first president of post-apartheid South Africa. Here he is in his inaugural address, 1994.
We know it well that none of us acting alone can achieve success. We must therefore act together as a united people for national reconciliation, for nation building, for the birth of a new world.
Margaret Thatcher, Great Britain's Iron Lady, died in April. Here she is in 1984, speaking before the House of Commons, defending her decision to send warships to the Falkland Islands.
Falkland Islands and their dependencies remain British territory. No aggression and no invasion can alter that simple fact.
And longtime high-profile film critic Roger Ebert of Siskel and Ebert fame died in April after a long battle with cancer. On July 12, 2005, proclaimed Roger Ebert Day in the city of Chicago, he joked with a crowd of admirers that not everyone understood what he did.
My mother's friends never knew what I did. And how is Roger? They would have sons who were lawyers, doctors. And how is Roger? Is he still just going to the movies?
Just going to the movies. We're looking at the news and footprint of the year 2013 with David Sanger of the New York Times, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post. Karen, David, let's go to culture for a moment. Culture and law. DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court this year. Gay marriage now legal in more states than ever before. We've got big change coming here, Karen.
The big change, though, seems to be following a big societal change. That if you look at any polls of this year, for the first time, the Washington Post poll showed that there's actually a building public support for gay marriage, and it's especially strong among young people. So we saw the Supreme Court strike down DOMA. We saw them allow gay marriage to continue in California. And we end the year with a court declaring gay marriage legal in Utah. You know, possibly, you know, it's one of the most conservative and religious states in the country. So that does tell us that this is going to be back in the courts. But I do think that the real change is going on in people's own hearts and in people's own minds on this issue.
How deep, how wide that change? I mean, put all that up against the remaining states that do not have legalized gay marriage. Put it up against the cultural moments this year. You know, a little bit of Paula Deen, a whole lot in the last couple of weeks of Phil Robertson and the Duck Dynasty stuff as indicators of, that maybe here, too, we have unresolved stretch of views, breadth of views in this country.
Well, it's interesting because if you talk to even, for instance, evangelical leaders, they will acknowledge that looking out into their own pews, they see among the young people an entirely different attitude on gay marriage than you hear among their elders.
Here we had the Supreme Court overturning the Defense of Marriage Act. This was Edith Windsor, the plaintiff in that case. Windsor versus the USA. Her statement after the Supreme Court said no to DOMA.
The Supreme Court has announced its decision in Windsor versus the United States. And we won everything we asked and hoped for. Wow. I'm honored and humbled and overjoyed to be here today.
David Sanger, what do you see unfolding culturally on this front?
I think it's pretty remarkable, Tom, because if you think about the number of states now that allow gay marriage either by legislation or constitutional change in the states or by court order, there's been more motion on this in the past year or two than in the previous 40. I mean, there really was the breaking of a dam, and I think that Karen had it exactly right. When you talk to young people on this of any political persuasion, this issue is pretty well over. Now, for the time being, it has cast the coasts against the middle of the country. That is changing in the middle of the country as well. And, you know, the Supreme Court tried to do the DOMA decision fairly narrowly in that it did not say whether or not states were required to allow gay marriage. It only said that once a gay couple is proclaimed married, then that has to be recognized, mm-hmm. you know, around and by the federal government. But now, with the Utah case that Karen referred to, this could well end up right back in the Supreme Court very quickly because the judge in the Utah case refused to stay his own decision. So there are gay marriages taking place in Utah. The state of Utah is trying to go fight that. And you could see the Supreme Court being asked to rule on the on staying this just in the next few weeks.
And it's extraordinary how fast this has happened.
Yes.
I may have this number wrong, but in the 2004 election, gay marriage was on the ballot in over a dozen states. It may have been as many as 17. And in every single instance, the anti-gay marriage forces won. So to see this kind of societal change happen in this few years is just extraordinary.
Let's go to Rick in Des Moines, Iowa. Rick, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. My my comment is that I found 2013 to be very interesting in the sense that from a local level, I feel confident in what we've done and where we've come from everything from gay marriage that we were just talking about or that you were just talking about to supporting the arts. A lot of infrastructure changes at local levels have been very successful, whereas nationally or as a country, I've lost a lot of faith in what my government or what my country is able to do for the people or for other countries. So I feel hopeful for the future, but it's going to take a while to get there, it feels like.
Hopeful from the local level. That is interesting. A time, I don't know what to make of this, Karen. It has been a large push by conservatives to diminish the role of the federal government, though it's still quite large. But now we see, at least in Rick's view, hope at the local level and not at the federal level. Is this positive, negative? How do you look at it, Karen?
Well, I think Rick's view is very, very typical. We saw this year one survey after another showing that most Americans' faith in Washington has never been lower. And let's face it, that has been a goal of the Tea Party movement, is to, you know, make Washington less and less relevant in people's lives. And so in some ways it's almost mission accomplished, but I do think that, when we look to our political leaders of the future, they are in fact going to be probably coming out from among our governors, and, you know, a lot is getting done in the cities. Mayors are incredibly active and proactive. So, you know, it may be that the rest of the country can show Washington the way.
Does it make for effective national strategy, David Sanger, cumulatively?
Well, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. I think that at the local level, you don't see the kind of execution problems we've had at the national level. And sometimes at the local level, though not always, you don't see the kind of partisan splits. You see more people gathering together to find solutions. So that's the good news. The bad news out of this is that if you're thinking of the United States as a global player, there isn't very much in the training that one gets coming up through local politics to think strategically about the place of the United States in the world. And in the Senate, we no longer have the range of people on both sides of the aisle who actually spent a lot of their careers doing that. Well, many of those have retired. There are a few left, but not many. And so what I worry about is that the same impetus that Karen has described, which I think is fundamentally healthy, of finding solutions out in the country and not trying to find them in D.C., can also work against us a little bit if one of our concerns is that the country is growing more insular.
But let me ask you on that front. We haven't really talked about Edward Snowden. Everything that he's revealed, and many are appalled by it, others support it, but it's a lot, and it's controversial. All of that was implemented by your Washington veterans, David.
It certainly was, and I think that the Snowden revelations, which I think are among the most fascinating events of 2013, come in. I think we have to think of it at the end of the year in three different categories. They're the civil rights questions, which come out of, or the civil liberties questions, which come out of the question of, do you want the government collecting up all your phone records, not the conversations, but the phone records, so they can search them to stop terrorism. And on that issue, I thought it was fascinating that the advisory panel appointed by the president, including several intelligence professionals, came out and said, no, this doesn't need to be done by the federal government. If it needs to be done at all, it can be done privately. Then there's the second question, which is, are all of the big issues that Snowden's raising ending up having more business effect for the United States than diplomatic effect? And there's a reason you're seeing every one of the telecommunications companies and the Silicon Valley executives coming out and saying, if the United States feels as if it can go around and break encryption and develop new cyber weapons and so forth without affecting the sales of cloud services, American products, high-tech products abroad, the things the world wants to buy most from the United States, then we're living in another world. And I think that's going to be one of the big pressures on the government in 2014. And then I think that the third effect that's coming out of it is just a distrust of whether or not President Obama, who was against many of these programs or at least skeptical of them as senator, is now embracing them as president.
We'll see soon enough how he responds to the pressure and controversy. Kit in Hooks at New Hampshire. Kit, you're on the air. What do you take from 2013, Kit?
Hi, Tom. Well, my saddest moment was a long one, 4 to 5 months, and that was the illness and then death of Nelson Mandela. But that long moment gave birth to my most hopeful, most wonderful moment, which is the celebration that we saw from the South Africans and others around the world about this incredible man and the wonderful, wonderful life he lived. And I think we have a lot to learn from the South Africans about how to handle the passing of a great person like Nelson Mandela.
A giant figure.
I just want to add real quickly for the caller whose saddest moment was that she thought that the Republicans would have won against Obama if it hadn't been for the IRS problem with the groups.
Yes.
I just want to say that that's been happening to left organizations for decades and decades and decades and decades, and it went on. It came out in about hour 72 of the 24-hour news cycle that it happened just as much to left groups.
We take your point and your salute to Nelson Mandela right there. Karen Tumulty, maybe related to that. Interesting, this year we've been talking about inequality for a long time, not because it's not, I mean, it's part and parcel at some level of the system that's made this country very prosperous, but it seems to, in recent years, to have just gone to extremes that are giving the economy and the country trouble now. What about that legacy of 2013? Is this the year that that made it onto the sort of firm national agenda, Karen?
Well, I think there is an economic argument to be made that income inequality has reached the point where it is actually impeding our economic growth and our economic health. But I am still skeptical of the degree to which, first of all, Washington and especially today's Washington can do anything about it, since a lot of this is being shaped by global economic forces. And second of all, the degree to which it truly will get any political traction, because, we've heard politicians talk about it, but, to get people to actually get up and cast their votes based on income inequality is something that I think hasn't happened probably, going back to, the New Deal.
But it has happened in this country before in times of crisis. Now we've got David Sanger, this voice out of the Vatican, Pope Francis talking a lot about all kinds of things, including very much in recent weeks, inequality. This is new for the Pope to be leaning in this direction. What about the overall tone globally in this country, the effect of the Pope, but just the political conversation here, David, of this awareness, acute awareness of inequality?
It is it's remarkable how quickly he has changed the image of the papacy. It is remarkable because if we were doing the same roundup two or three years ago, we probably would have been discussing the Pope in terms of the scandals that surrounded the church, and instead you're discussing and raising the inequality issues. And because President Obama himself has seen in the Pope's language a sort of return to some of the themes that he enunciated in 2008 and lost over the past 5 years. And it's interesting to see the degree to which you see the president now referring to some of the Pope's own statements. They're not because of any particular religious affinity with the Catholic Church, but because he believes that the Pope is becoming a force for many of those themes that he tried to do in the American election in 2008. I thought one of the most remarkable photos the other day was of the the former pope and the current pope together. That when you think about the way succession happens in the church, you so rarely see an opportunity when that ever happens, because popes have died before,
of course,
before they are replaced. And it was, I think, it further contrasted the difference here.
And as a Catholic myself, I looked at this transition and I thought, the cardinals have picked this guy. He's sort of elderly. He doesn't have a sort of power base in the Vatican. He comes from Latin America. My own, again, perhaps cynical impression was, this guy is not going to be very consequential. And then, boom, he's suddenly everywhere and getting people to talk about things in the church and outside the church that they hadn't been talking about.
With a moral call from Pope Francis. We'll talk more about the economy as soon as the new year begins. But Karen, what are you feeling on that front? Jobs would help on a lot of fronts in this country. Economic comeback in the works or no?
It sure feels like it. That's probably one of the few good things you can say about this year.
We'll take something. We'll take that. That could make a lot of things easier and better. So grateful to the two of you for taking a little time out here at Year's End to look at 2013. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you very much, Karen, for being with us.
Happy New Year to you and David and all your listeners.
Same to you. Thanks so much. And David Sanger in Weston, Vermont today, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Happy New Year. Thanks so much, David.
Happy New Year to you, Tom, and to Karen, and to all who tune in to us.
One more who's gone on this year, Richie Havens. Here he is performing Freedom, Woodstock, 1969. Thanks for joining us today, 2013. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Alone.